captivity. Someone is trying to send you a message, attorney Alejandro says, scant minutes into his first interview with his new client. Randy's ready for it. Why does everyone here have these incredibly cumbersome ways of sending me messages? Don't you people have email? The Philippines are one of those countries where attorney is used as a title, like doctor. Attorney Alejandro has a back-swept gray pompadour that gets a little curly down around the nape of his neck, which, as he probably well knows, makes him look distinguished in a 19th-century statesman kind of way. He smokes a lot, which bothers Randy hardly a bit since he has been in places for a couple of days where everyone smokes. You don't even need to bother with cigarettes and matches in a jail. Just breathe and you get the equivalent of one or two packs a day worth of slightly pre-owned tar and nicotine. Attorney Alejandro decides to act as if Randy has never made this last comment. He attends to a bit of business with his cigarette. If he wants that cigarette up and burning between his lips, he can make it happen without even moving his hands. Suddenly, it's just there, as if he had been hiding it already lit inside his mouth. But if he needs to introduce a caesura into the conversation, he can turn the selection, preparation, and ignition of a cigarette into something that in terms of solemn ritual is just this side of the chanoyu. It must knock him dead in the courtroom. Randy's feeling better already. What do you suppose the message is? That they are capable of killing me if they want to? Because I already know that. I mean, shit, how much does it cost to have a man killed in Manila? Attorney Alejandro frowns fiercely. He has taken this question the wrong way, as a suggestion that he is the kind of guy who would know such a thing. Of course, given that he was personally recommended by Douglas MacArthur Shafto, he probably is just precisely that kind of guy. But it is probably rude to aver this. Your imagination is running wild, he says. You have blown the death penalty aspect of this thing all out of proportion. As Attorney Alejandro probably expected, this display of blitheness renders Randy speechless long enough for him to execute another bit of patter with a cigarette and a stainless steel lighter encrusted with military regalia. Attorney Alejandro has mentioned twice that he was a colonel in the army and lived for years in the States. We reinstated the death penalty in 1995 after a hiatus of 10 years approximately. The word approximately crackles and explodes from his mouth like a spark from a Tesla coil. Filipinos enunciate better than Americans, and they know it. Randy and Alejandro are meeting in a high, narrow room somewhere in between the jail and the courtroom in Makati. A prison guard loitered in the room with them for a few minutes, hunched over with sheepishness, leaving only when Attorney Alejandro went over and spoke to him in low, fatherly tones and pressed something into his hand. There is an open window, and the sound of honking horns comes through it from the street 2 stories below. Randy's half expecting Doug Shafto and his comrades to rappel down from the roof and enter suddenly in glittering and screaming cloaks of broken window glass and extract Randy while Attorney Alejandro heaves his bulk against this half-ton narrow table and uses it to block the door shut. Coming up with fantasies like this one helps to break the tedium of being in jail, and probably does a lot to explain Randy's jailmate's taste in videos, which they cannot actually watch, but which they talk about incessantly. The videos, or rather the lack of them, has given rise to some kind of retrograde media evolution phenomenon, an oral storytelling rooted in videos that these guys once saw. A particularly affecting description of, for example, Stallone in Rambo 3 cauterizing his abdominal bullet wound by igniting a torn-open rifle cartridge and shooting gunpowder flames through it will plunge all of the men into several moments of reverent awe. It is about the only quiet time Randy gets now, and he has consequently begun cooking up a new plan. He will exploit his Californian provenance by asserting that he has seen martial arts films that have not yet been bootlegged to the streets of Manila, and narrate them in terms so eloquent that the entire jailhouse will, for a few minutes, become a place of monastic contemplation, like the idealized third-world prison that Randy wishes he were in. Randy read Papillon cover to cover a couple of times when he was a kid and has always imagined third-world prisons as places of supreme and noble isolation, steep tropical sunlight, setting the humid and smoky air aglow as it slants in over iron bars, close-set in thick masonry walls. Sweaty, shirtless Steppenwolves prowling back and forth in their cells, brooding about where it all went wrong. Prison journals furtively scribbled on cigarette papers. Instead, the jail where they've been keeping Randy is just a really crowded urban society where some of the people cannot actually leave. Everyone there is extremely young, except for Randy and an ever-rotating population of drunks. It makes him feel old. If he sees one more video-addled boy strutting around in a bootleg Hard Rock Cafe t-shirt and fronting hand gestures from American gangster rappers, he may actually have to become a murderer. Attorney Alejandro says, rhetorically, "Why death to drug smugglers?" Randy hasn't asked why, but Attorney Alejandro wants to share something with him about why. "The Americans were very angry that some people in this part of the world persisted in selling them the drugs that they want so very badly." "Sorry, what can I say? We suck. I know we suck. And so, as a gesture of friendship between our peoples, we instituted the death penalty. The law specified 2 and only 2 methods of execution." Attorney Alejandro continues, "The gas chamber and the electric chair. As you can see, we took our lead, in this as in many other things, some wise and some foolish, from the Americans. Now, at the time, we did not have a gas chamber anywhere in the Philippines. A study was made. Plans were drawn up. Do you have any idea what is involved in constructing a proper gas chamber?" Attorney Alejandro now goes off on a fairly lengthy riff, but Randy finds it hard to concentrate until something in Attorney Alejandro's tone tells them that a coda is approaching. "Prison service said, how can you expect us to construct this space-age facility when we have not even the funds to purchase rat poison for the overcrowded prisons we already have? As you can see, they were just whining for more funding. You see?" Attorney Alejandro raises his eyebrows significantly and sucks in his cheeks. As he reduces a good 2 or 3 centimeters of a Marlboro to ash, that he feels it necessary to explain the underlying motivations of the prison service so baldly seems to imply that his estimate of Randy's intelligence is none too favorable, which, given the way he was arrested at the airport, might be fair enough. "So this left only the electric chair. But do you imagine what happened to the electric chair?"
"I can't imagine," Randy says.
"It burned. Faulty wiring. So we had no way to cure people."
All of a sudden, Attorney Alejandro, who has betrayed no amusement thus far, remembers to laugh. It is perfunctory, and by the time Randy has bestirred himself to show a little polite amusement, it's over, and Alejandro's back to being serious.
"But Filipinos are highly adaptable." "Once again," Attorney Alejandro says, "we look to America. Our friend, our patron, our big brother. You are familiar with the expression, Ninong?"
"Of course you are. I forget you have spent a whole lot of time here."
Randy is always impressed by the mixture of love, hate, hope, disappointment, admiration, and derision that Filipinos express towards America. Having actually been a part of the United States at one point, they can take digs at it in a way that's usually reserved for lifelong U.S. citizens. The failure of the United States to protect them from Nippon after Pearl Harbor is still the most important thing that ever happened to them. Probably just slightly more important than MacArthur's return to the country a few years later. If that doesn't inculcate a love-hate relationship.
"The Americans," Attorney Alejandro continues, "were also reeling under the expense of executing people and having embarrassments with their electric chairs. Maybe they should have jobbed it out."
"Pardon me?" Randy says. He gets the idea that Attorney Alejandro is just checking to see if he's awake.
"Jobbed it out to the Nipponese. Gone to Sony or Panasonic or one of those guys and said,"
now reverting to a perfect American yokel accent,
"we just love the VCRs that y'all been selling us. Why don't you make an electric chair that actually works?"
Which the Nips would have done. It is the kind of thing that they would excel at. And then, after they sold Americans all of the electric chairs they needed,
we could have purchased some factory seconds at cut rate. Whenever Filipinos slag America in earshot of an American, they usually try to follow it up with some really vile observations about the Nipponese, just to put everything in perspective.
Where are we going with this? Randy says.
Oh, please forgive my digression. The Americans had gone over to executing prisoners by lethal injection, and so we have once again decided to take a cue from them.
Why didn't we just hang people? We have plenty of rope. This is where rope comes from, you know.
Yes, or shoot them. We have plenty of guns. But no, the Congress wanted to be modern like Uncle Sam, and so lethal injection it was. But then we sent a delegation to see how the Americans lethally injected people, and you know what they reported when they came back?
It takes all kinds of special equipment.
It takes all kinds of special equipment, and a special room. This room has not yet been constructed. So, you know how many people we have on death row now?
I can't imagine.
More than 250. Even if the room were built tomorrow, most of them could not be executed because it is illegal to carry out the execution until 1 year has passed since the final appeal.
Well, wait a minute. If you've lost your final appeal, then why wait a whole year?
Attorney Alejandro shrugs.
In America, they usually do the final appeal while the prisoner is lying strapped to the table with the needle in his arm.
Maybe they wait, in case there is a miracle during that year. We are a very religious people. Even some of the death row prisoners are very religious. But they are now begging to be executed. They cannot stand the wait any longer.
Attorney Alejandro laughs and slaps the table.
Now, Randy, all of these 250 people are poor. All of them.
He stops significantly.
I hear you, Randy says. Did you know that my net worth is less than zero, by the way?
Yes, but you are rich in friends and connections.
Attorney Alejandro starts frisking himself. A picture of a fresh pack of Marlboro appears over his head in a little thought balloon.
I recently received a telephone call from a friend of yours in Seattle.
Chester?
Yes, he's the one. He has money.
You could say that.
Chester is seeking ways to put his financial resources to work on your behalf. He feels frustrated and unsure of himself because while his resources are quite significant, he does not know the fine points of how to wield them in the context of the Philippine judicial system.
That's him all over. Is there any chance that you might be able to give him some pointers?
I'll talk to him.
Let me ask you this, Randy says. I understand that financial resources wielded properly could free me, but what if some rich person wanted to use his money to send me to death row?
This one stops Attorney Alejandro dead for a minute.
There are more efficient ways for a wealthy person to kill someone. For the reasons I have described, a would-be assassin would first look somewhere outside of the Philippine capital punishment apparatus. That is why, in my opinion, as your lawyer, what is really going on here is that
someone is trying to send me a message.
Exactly. You see, now you are beginning to understand.
Well, I'm wondering if you could give me a ballpark estimate of how long I'm going to be locked up. I mean, do you want me to plead to a lesser charge and then serve a few years?
Attorney Alejandro looks pained and scoffs. He doesn't deign to answer.
I didn't think so, says Randy. But at what point in these proceedings do you imagine I could get out? I mean, they refuse to release me on bail.
Of course. You are charged with a capital crime. Even though everyone knows it is a joke, proper respect must be shown.
They pulled the planted drugs out of my bag. There are a million witnesses.
It was a drug, right? Malaysian heroin. Very pure,
Attorney Alejandro says admiringly.
So there are all of these people who can testify that a sack of heroin was found in my luggage. That would seem to complicate the job of getting me out of jail.
We can probably get it dismissed before an actual trial is launched. By pointing out flaws in the evidence,
Attorney Alejandro says. Something in his tone of voice and the way he's staring out the window suggests this is the first time he's actually thought about how he's going to specifically attack this problem.
Perhaps a baggage handler at Naya will step forward and testify
that he saw a shadowy figure planting the drugs in your bag.
A shadowy figure?
Yes, says Attorney Alejandro, irritably, anticipating sarcasm.
Are there a lot of those hanging around backstage at Naya?
We don't need a lot.
How much time do you think might pass before this baggage handler's conscience finally gets the better of him and he decides to step forward?
Attorney Alejandro shrugs.
A couple of weeks, perhaps, for it to be done properly. How are your accommodations?
They suck, but you know what? Nothing really bothers me anymore.
There is concern among some of the officials of the prison service that when you get out, you may say harsh things about the conditions.
Since when do they care?
You are a little famous in America. Not very famous, a little. Do you remember the American boy in Singapore who was caned?
Of course.
Very bad publicity for Singapore. So there are officials of the prison service who would be sympathetic to the idea of putting you in a private cell. Clean. Quiet.
Randy cops a questioning look and holds up one hand and rubs his thumb and fingers together in the money gesture.
It is done already.
Chester?
No. Someone else.
Avi?
Attorney Alejandro shakes his head.
The Shaftos?
I cannot answer your question, Randy, because I do not know. I was not involved in this decision. But whoever did it was also listening to your request for some way to kill the time. You requested books?
Yeah, do you have some?
No, but they will allow this.
Attorney Alejandro now opens up his briefcase, reaches in with both hands, and pulls out Randy's new laptop.
It still has a police evidence sticker on it.
Give me a fucking break, Randy says.
No, take it.
Isn't it like evidence or something?
The police are finished. They have opened it up and looked for drugs inside. Dusted it for fingerprints. You can still see the dust. I hope that it did not damage the delicate machinery.
Yeah, me too. So, are you telling me that I'm free to take this to my new, clean, quiet, private cell?
That is what I am telling you.
And I can use it there? No restrictions?
They will give you an electrical socket, a plug-in,
Attorney Alejandro says, and then adds significantly,
I ask them.
Which is clearly a little reminder that any fees eventually paid to him will have been richly earned.
Randy draws a nice deep breath, thinking,
well, it is just fantastically generous, in fact, a little bit startling, that the powers that want to convict and execute me are willing to go to such lengths to allow me to dick around on my computer while I am awaiting my trial and death. He exhales and says,
thank God. At least I'll be able to get some work done.
Attorney Alejandro nods approvingly.
Your girlfriend is waiting to see you, he announces.
She's not really my girlfriend.
What does she want? Randy demands.
What do you mean, what does she want? She wants to see you, to give you emotional support, to let you know that you are not all alone.
Shit, Randy mutters. I don't want emotional support. I want to get the fuck out of jail.
That is my department,
Attorney Alejandro says proudly. You know what this is. It's one of those men are from Mars, women are from Venus things.
I have not heard of this phrase, but I understand immediately what you are saying.
It's one of those American books where once you've heard the title, you don't even need to read it, Randy says.
Then I won't.
You and I see just that someone is trying to fuck me over and then I need to get out of jail. Very simple and clean. But to her, it is much more than that. It is an opportunity to have a conversation.
Attorney Alejandro just rolls his eyes and makes the universal female's yammering gesture, thumb and fingertips closing and opening like a disembodied flapping jaw.
To share deep feelings and emotionally bond,
Randy continues, closing his eyes.
But this is not so bad,
Attorney Alejandro says, radiating insincerity like a mirrored ball in a disco.
I'm doing okay in this jail. Surprisingly okay, Randy says. But it's all about keeping up a kind of emotionless front. Many barriers between me and my surroundings. So it just makes me crazy that she's picking this particular moment to implicitly demand that I let my guard down.
She knows you are weak, Attorney Alejandro says, and winks. She smells your vulnerability.
That's not all she's going to smell.
Is this new cell going to have a shower?
Everything. Remember to put something heavy on the drain so that rats do not climb up out of it during the night.
Thanks. I'll just put my laptop there.
Randy leans back in his chair and wiggles his butt around. There is a problem now with an erection. It has been at least a week for Randy. 3 nights in the jail, the night before that at Tom Howard's house, before that the airplane, before that Abby's basement floor. Actually, it has probably been a lot more than a week. Randy needs badly to get into that private cell, if for no other reason than it will give him an opportunity to vent that which is bearing down hard on his prostate gland and get his mind back on an even keel. He prays to God that he's only going to be seeing Amy through a thick glass partition. Attorney Alejandro opens the door and says something to the waiting guard, who leads them down a hallway toward another room. This one's bigger. It has a number of long tables with little familial clusters of Filipinos scattered about. If these tables were ever intended to serve as barriers against physical contact, it has long been forgotten. It would take something more like the Berlin Wall to prevent Filipinos from showing affection for each other. So Amy is there, already striding around the end of one of the tables as a couple of guards pointedly look the other way, though their eyes dart back to check out her ass after she is blown by them. No dress this time. Randy predicts it will be a few years before he sees Amy in a dress again. Last time he did, his dick got hard, his heart pounded, he literally salivated, and then suddenly armed men were putting handcuffs on him. Right now, Amy's in old jeans ripped out at the knee, a tank top undershirt, and a black leather jacket, better to accommodate her concealed weapons. Knowing the Shaftos, they've probably gone to some very high DEFCON level, the one just short of all-out nuclear exchange. Doug Shafto probably showers with a seal knife clenched in his teeth now. Amy, who normally goes for a low one-armed, sidelong type of hug, now throws both arms up, as if signaling a touchdown, and crooks both elbows behind the nape of Randy's neck and lets him feel everything. The flesh of his lower belly can count the stitch marks in Amy's appendectomy scar. So that he has a boner is probably about as obvious to her as that he smells bad. He might as well have one of those long fluorescent orange bicycle flags lashed to the shaft of his phallus and sticking up out of his pants. She steps back, looks down at it, then very deliberately looks him in the eye and says,
"How do you feel?"
Which, being as it is the obligatory question of females, is hard to read. Deadpan ironic or just sweetly naive?
"I miss you," he says, "and I apologize if my limbic system has misinterpreted your gesture of emotional support."
She takes this levelly, shrugs, and says,
"No need to apologize. It's all a part of you, Randy. I don't have to get to know you in pieces, do I?"
Randy resists the impulse to check his watch, which would be pointless because it has been confiscated anyway. She has undoubtedly set some kind of world speed record here, in the male-female conversation category, for working the subject around to Randy's own failure to be emotionally available. To do it in this setting displays a certain chutzpah that he cannot help but admire.
"You've talked to Attorney Alejandro?"
she says.
"Yeah.
I assume he's imparted to me whatever he was supposed to impart."
"I don't have much more for you," she says,
which on a pure tactical level means a lot. If the wreck had been found by the dentist's minions or their salvage work had been somehow interrupted, she'd say something. For her to say nothing means that they are probably hauling gold out of that submarine at this very moment. So, she's busy working on the gold salvage operation, to which her contributions are no doubt vital. She has absolutely no specific information to impart to him about anything. So why has she made the long, alternately dull and dangerous trek to Manila? In order to do what exactly? It is one of these fiendish mind-reading exercises. She has her arms crossed over her bosom and is eyeing him coolly. Someone is trying to send you a message. He suddenly gets the feeling that she's got him right where she wants him. Maybe she's the one who planted the heroin in his bag. It's a power thing, that's all. A big slab of memory floats up to the surface of Randy's mind like a floe calved off the polar ice cap. He and Amy and the Shafto boys were in California right after the earthquake, going through all the old crap in the basement, looking for a few key boxes of papers. Randy heard Amy squealing with laughter and found her sitting in the corner on top of some old book boxes, reading a paperback novel by flashlight. She had uncovered a huge cache of paperback romance novels, none of which Randy had ever seen before. Bodice rippers of the most incredibly cheesy sort. Randy assumed they'd been left behind by the house's previous owners until he flipped through a couple of them, checking the copyright dates. All from the years when he and Charlene were living together. Charlene must have been reading them at a rate of about one a week.
"Ooh, baby,"
Amy said, and read him a passage about a rugged but sensitive but tough but loving but horny but smart hero having his way with a protesting but willing but struggling but yielding tempestuous female.
God!
She frisbeed the book into a puddle on the basement floor. I always got the sense she had furtive reading habits.
Well, now you know what she wanted, Amy said. Did you give her what she wanted, Randy?
And Randy has been thinking about that ever since. And when he got over his surprise that Charlene was a bodice ripper addict, he decided it wasn't necessarily a bad thing, though in her circle, reading books like that would be tantamount to wearing a tall, pointy hat in the streets of Salem Village, Mass., circa 1692. She and Randy had tried awfully hard to have an egalitarian relationship. They had spent money on relationship counseling, trying to keep the egalitarian relationship alive. But she had become more and more angry, without ever giving him a reason, and he had become more and more confused. Eventually, he stopped being confused and just got irritated and tired of her. After Amy discovered those books in the basement, Randy slowly put a whole new and different story together in his head. That Charlene's limbic system was simply hooked up in such a way that she liked dominant men. Again, not in a whips and chains sense, just in the sense that in most relationships, someone's got to be active and someone's got to be passive. And there's no particular logic to that, but there's nothing bad about it either. In the end, the passive partner can have just as much power and just as much freedom. Intuition, like a flash of lightning, lasts only for a second. It generally comes when one is tormented by a difficult decipherment, and when one reviews in his mind the fruitless experiments already tried. Suddenly, the light breaks through and one finds, after a few minutes, what previous days of labor were unable to reveal. Randy has this very strong feeling that Amy doesn't read bodice ripper novels. She goes the other way. She can't tolerate surrendering to anyone, which makes it hard for her to function in polite society. She could not have been happy sitting at home during her senior year of high school waiting for a boy to invite her to the prom. This feature of her personality is extremely prone to misinterpretation, so she bailed out. She would rather be lonely and true to herself and in control in an out-of-the-way part of the world, with her music by intelligent female singer-songwriters to keep her company, than misinterpreted and hassled in America.
I love you, he says.
Amy looks away and heaves a big sigh, like, at last we're getting somewhere. Randy continues. I've been infatuated with you ever since we met. Now she's back to looking at him expectantly. And the reason I've been slow to actually show it or do anything about it is, first of all, because I wasn't sure whether or not you were a lesbian. Amy scoffs and rolls her eyes. And later, just because of my own reticence, which is unfortunately part of me too, just like this part. He glances down just for a microsecond. She's shaking her head at him in amazement. The fact that the scientific investigator works 50% of his time by non-rational means is quite insufficiently recognized, Randy says. Amy sits down on his side of the table, jackknifes, spins around neatly on her ass, and comes to light on the other side.
I'll think about what you said, she says.
Hang in there, sport. Amy gives him a little smile over her shoulder, then walks straight to the exit, turning around once in the doorway to make sure he's still looking at her. He is, which he feels quite confident is the right answer. Glamour. A couple of squads of Nipponese Air Force soldiers, armed with rifles and Nambus, pursue Bobby Shafto and his crew of hooks towards the Manila Bay seawall. If it comes to the point where they must stand and slug it out, they can probably kill a lot of Nips before they are overwhelmed. But they are here to find and assist the Altamiras, not to die heroically. And so they retreat through the neighborhood of Ermita. One of MacArthur's circling Piper Cubs catches sight of one of those Nip squads as it is clambering over the ruins of a collapsed building and calls in a strike. Artillery rounds spiral in from the north like long passes in a football game. Shafto and the hooks try to time the incoming rounds, guessing at how many tubes are firing on them, trying to run from one place of concealment to the next when they think there's going to be a few seconds' pause in the shrapnel. Maybe half of the Nips are killed or wounded by this barrage, but they are fighting at such close quarters that two of Shafto's hooks are hit as well. Shafto is trying to drag one of them out of danger when he looks down and sees that he is stomping across a mess of shattered white crockery that is marked with the name of a hotel. The same hotel where he slow-danced with glory on the night that the war started. The wounded hooks are still capable of moving, and so the retreat continues. Shafto's calming down a bit, thinking about the situation with more clarity. The hooks find a good defensive position and stall the attackers for a few minutes while he gets his bearings, works out a plan. 15 minutes later, the hooks abandon their position and fall back in panic, or appear to. About half of the Nipponese squad rushes forward in pursuit and finds that they have been lured into a killing ground, a cul-de-sac created by the partial collapse of a building into an alley. One of the hooks opens up with a Tommy gun while Shafto, who stayed behind, hiding in a burned-out car, heaves grenades at the other half of the squad, pinning them down and preventing them from coming to help their comrades, who are being noisily slaughtered. But these Nips are relentless. They regroup under a surviving officer and continue their pursuit. Shafto, now on his own, ends up being chased around the foundations of another hotel, a luxury place that rises up above the bay, near the American Embassy. He trips over the body of a young woman who apparently leapt, fell, or was thrown from one of the windows. Crouching behind some shrubbery for a breather, he hears a shrill keening drifting out of the hotel's windows. The place is full of women, he realizes, and all of them are either screaming or sobbing. His pursuers seem to have lost track of him. The hooks have lost him, too. Shafto stays there for a while, listening to all of those women, wishing he could go inside and do something for them. But the place must be filled with Nip soldiers, or else the women wouldn't be screaming as they are. He listens carefully for a while, trying to ignore the lamentations of the women. A 14-year-old girl in a bloody nightgown plummets down from the 5th floor of the hotel, thuds into the ground like a sack of cement, and bounces once. Shafto closes his eyes and listens until he is absolutely sure that he does not hear any children. The picture's getting clearer now. The males are marched away and killed. The women are marched off in another direction. Young women without children are brought to this hotel. Women with children must have been taken somewhere else. Where? He hears Tommy gunfire on the other side of the hotel. It must be his buddies. He creeps around to a corner of the hotel and listens again, trying to figure out where they are. Somewhere in Rizal Park, he thinks. But then MacArthur's artillery opens up, hell for leather, and the world begins to heave beneath him like a rug being shaken, and he can't hear trench brooms or screaming women or anything. He has a view east and south towards the parts of Ermita and Malate, from which they have just come, and he can see big pieces of debris spinning up from the ground over there and gouts of dust. He has seen enough of war to know what it means. The Americans are advancing from the south now as well, pushing towards Intramuros. Shafto and his band of hooks were operating on their own, but it appears
that they have inadvertently served as harbingers of a big infantry thrust. Terrified by the barrage, a bunch of NIP soldiers stagger out of a side exit of the hotel, almost too drunk to stand, some of them still pulling their trousers up. Shafto disgustedly throws a grenade at them and then gets the hell out without bothering to examine the results. It is getting to the point where killing NIPs is no fun anymore. There is no sense of accomplishment in it. It is a tedious and dangerous job that never seems to end. When will these stupid bastards knock it off? They are embarrassing themselves in front of the whole world. He finds his men in Rizal Park, beneath the shadow of Intramuros' ancient Spanish wall, disputing possession of a baseball diamond with what is left of the Nipponese squads that pursued them here. The timing is both good and bad. Any earlier, and NIP reinforcements in the surrounding neighborhood would have heard the skirmish, flooded into the park, and wiped them out. Any later, and the American infantry would be here. But Rizal Park is in the middle of a deranged urban battleground right now, and nothing makes any kind of sense. They have to impose their will on the situation, the kind of thing Bobby Shafto has gotten fairly good at. The one thing they have going for them is that the artillery is pointed elsewhere for the time being. Shafto squats down behind a coconut tree and tries to figure out how the hell he is going to reach that baseball diamond, which is a couple of hundred yards away across totally flat, open ground. He knows the place. Uncle Jack took him to a baseball game there. Wooden bleachers rise along the left and right field lines. Beneath each one is a dugout. Shafto knows how battles work, and so he knows that one of those dugouts is full of NIPs and one is full of hooks, and that they are pinned down in them by each other's fire, just like Great War troops in their opposing trenches. There are a few buildings under the bleachers, containing toilets and a refreshment stand. The NIPs and the hooks will be creeping through those buildings right now, trying to get into a position from which they can shoot into the dugouts. A Nipponese grenade flies toward him from the direction of the left field bleachers, making a stripping noise as it passes through the fronds of a palm tree. Shafto ducks his head behind another tree so that he can't see the grenade. It explodes and tears the clothing and a good deal of the skin from one of his arms and one of his legs. But like all Nip grenades, it is poorly made and miserably ineffectual. Shafto turns around and uncorks a spume of 45 caliber rounds in the general direction the grenade came from. This should give the thrower something to think about while Shafto gets his bearings. This is actually a stupid idea because he runs out of ammunition. He has a few rounds in his Colt, and that's it. He also has one grenade left. He considers throwing it towards the baseball diamond, but his throwing arm is in pretty bad shape now. Besides, Jesus Christ, that baseball diamond is just too far away. Even in peak condition, he could not throw a grenade from here to there. Perhaps one of those corpses out in the grass between here and there isn't really a corpse. Shafto crawls towards them on his belly and establishes that they are most definitely dead people. Giving the field a wide berth, he begins working his way around behind home plate toward the right field line, where his people are. He would love to sneak up on the NIPs from behind, but that grenade thrower really threw a fright into him. Where the hell is he? The firing from the dugouts has become sporadic. They have stalemated now and are trying to conserve ammunition. Shafto risks rising to a crouch. He runs for about 3 paces before he sees the door to the women's toilet swing open and a man jump out, winding up like Bob Feller getting ready to throw a fastball right down the middle of the plate. Shafto fires his 45 once, but the weapon's absurdly vicious recoil jerks it right out of his lamed hand. The grenade comes flying towards him, perfectly on target. Shafto dives to the ground and scrambles for his 45. The grenade actually bounces off his shoulder and falls, spinning into the dust, making a fizzing noise. But it doesn't explode. Shafto looks up. The NIP is standing framed in the women's room door. His shoulders slump miserably. Shafto recognizes him. There's only one NIP who could throw a grenade like that. He lies there for a few moments, counting syllables on his fingers, then stands up, cups his hand around his mouth, and hollers,
"Pineapple fastball! Guns of Manila applaud! Hit by pitch! Free base!"
Gutto, Dango, and Bobby Shafto lock themselves inside the women's room and share a nip from a bottle of port that the former has looted from a store somewhere. They spend a few minutes catching up with each other in a general way. Gutto Dango is already somewhat drunk, which makes his grenade-throwing performance all the more impressive.
I'm hopped to the gills on Benzedrine, Shafto says. Keeps you going, but kind of screws up your aim.
I noticed,
Gutto Dango says. He is so skinny and haggard, he looks more like some hypothetical sick uncle of Gutto Dango's. Shafto pretends to take offense at this and drops into a judo stance. Gutto Dango laughs uneasily and waves him off.
No more fighting, he says.
A rifle bullet passes through the women's room wall and digs a crater into a porcelain sink.
We gotta come up with a plan,
Shafto says.
The plan. You live, I die,
Gutto Dango says.
Fuck that,
Shafto says.
Hey, don't you idiots know you're surrounded?
We know,
Gutto Dango says wearily.
We know for a long time.
So give up, you fucking morons. Wave a white flag and you can all go home.
It is not Nipponese way.
So come up with another fucking way. Show some fucking adaptability.
Why are you here?
Gutto Dango asks, changing the subject.
What is your mission?
Shafto explains that he's looking for his kid. Gutto Dango tells him where all of the women and children are, in the Church of St. Augustine in Intramuros.
Hey,
Shafto says.
If we surrender to you, you'll kill us, right?
Yes.
If you guys surrender to us, we won't kill you. Promise. Scout's honor.
For us, living or dying is not the important thing,
Gutto Dango says.
Hey, tell me something I didn't fucking already know,
Shafto says.
Even winning battles isn't important to you, is it?
Gutto Dango looks the other way, shamefaced.
Haven't you guys figured out yet that bonsai charges don't fucking work?
All of the people who learned that were killed in bonsai charges,
Gutto Dango says. As if on cue, the nips in the left field dugout begin screaming, Bonsai! And charge as one out onto the field. Shafto puts his eye up to a bullet hole in the wall and watches them stumbling across the infield with fixed bayonets. Their leader clambers up the pitcher's mound as if he's going to plant a flag there and takes a slug in the middle of his face. His men are being dismantled all around him by thoughtfully placed rifle slugs from the Hook's dugout. Urban warfare is not the métier of the Hook Ballahops, but calmly slaughtering bonsai-charging Nipponese is old hat. One of the Nips actually manages to crawl all the way to the first base coach's box. Then a few pounds of meat come flying out of his back, and he relaxes. Shafto turns to see that Gutto Dango is aiming a revolver at him. He chooses to ignore this for a moment.
See what I mean?
I have seen it many times before.
Then why aren't you dead?
Shafto asks the question with all due flippancy, but it has a terrible effect on Gutto Dango. His face scrunches up and he begins to cry.
Aw, shit. You pull a gun on me and start bawling at the same time? How unfair can you get? Why don't you kick some fucking dirt in my eyes while you're at it?
Gutto Dango lifts the revolver to his own temple. But Shafto sees that one coming a mile away. He knows Nips well enough by this point to figure out when they are about to go harry-carry on you. Shafto jumps forward as soon as the barrel of the revolver begins to move. By the time it is against Gutto Dango's skull, Shafto has his finger stuck into the gap between the hammer and the firing pin. Gutto Dango collapses to the floor, sobbing piteously. It just makes Shafto want to kick him.
Knock it off,
he says.
What the fuck is eating at you?
I came to Manila to redeem myself, to get back my lost honor,
Gutto Dango says.
I could have done it here. I could be dead on that field right now, and my spirit going to Yasukuni. But then you came. You ruined my concentration.
Concentrate on this, dumb shit,
Shafto says.
My son is in a church right over on the far side of that wall with a bunch of other helpless women and children. If you want to redeem yourself, why not help me get him out alive?
Gutto Dango seems to have gone into a trance now. His face, which was blubbering just a minute ago, has solidified into a mask.
I wish I could believe what you believe,
he says.
I have died, Bobby. I was buried in a rock tomb. If I were a Christian, I could be born again now and be a new man. Instead, I must go on living and accept my karma.
Well, shit! There's a padre right out there in the dugout. He can Christianize your ass in about 10 seconds flat.
Bobby Shafto strides across the bathroom and swings the door open. He is startled to see a man standing just a few paces away. The man is dressed in an old but clean khaki uniform, devoid of insignia except for a pentagon of stars on the collar. He has jammed a wooden match down into the bowl of a corncob pipe and is puffing away futilely. But it's as if all of the oxygen has been sucked out of the air by the burning of the city. He throws the match away in disgust, then looks up into the face of Bobby Shafto, staring at him through a pair of dark aviator sunglasses that give his gaunt face the appearance of a skull. His mouth forms into an O for a moment, then his jaw sets.
Shafto! Shafto! Shafto!
He says. Bobby Shafto feels his body stiffening to attention. Even if he had been dead for a few hours, his body would do this out of some kind of dumb, ingrained reflex.
Sir, yes, sir,
he says wearily. The general composes his thoughts for a half a second and then says,
You were supposed to be in Concepcion. You failed to be there. Your superiors did not know what to think. They have been worried sick about you, and the Department of the Navy has been positively insufferable ever since they became aware that you were working for me. They assert, in the most high-handed way, that you know important secrets and should never have been placed in danger of capture. In short, your whereabouts and your status have been the subject of the most intense, nay, feverish speculation for the last several weeks. Many supposed that you were dead, or worse, captured. This distraction has been most unwelcome to me, inasmuch as the planning and execution of the reconquest of the Philippine Islands have left me little time to devote to such nagging distractions.
An artillery shell rips through the air and detonates in the bleachers, sending jagged fragments of planks about the size of canoe paddles whirling through the air all around them. One of them embeds itself like a javelin in the dirt between the general and Bobby Shafto. The general takes advantage of this to draw breath and then continues as if he were reading this from a script.
And now, when I least expect it, I encounter you here, many leagues distant from your assigned post, out of uniform, in a disheveled condition, accompanied by a Nipponese officer, violating the sanctity of a lady's powder room. Shafto, have you no sense whatsoever of military honor? Do you not respect decorum? Do you not believe that a representative of the United States military should comport himself with more dignity?
Shafto's kneecaps are joggling up and down uncontrollably. His guts have become molten, and he feels strange bubbling processes going on in his rectum. His molars are chattering together like a teletype machine. He senses Goto Dengo behind him and wonders what the poor bastard can possibly be thinking.
Begging your pardon, General, not to change the subject or anything, but aren't you here all by yourself?
The general juts his chin towards the men's room.
My aides are in there relieving themselves. They were in a great hurry to do so, and it is good that we came upon this place, but none of them considered invading the powder room,
he says severely.
I apologize for that, sir,
Bobby Shafto says hastily,
and for all of those other things that you mentioned, but I still think of myself as a Marine, and Marines do not make excuses, so I will not even try.
That is not satisfactory. I need an explanation for where you've been.
I've been out in the world, Bobby Shafto says, getting butt-fucked by fortune.
The door of the men's room opens, and one of the general's aides walks out, woozy and bow-legged. The general ignores him. He is gazing right past Shafto now.
Pardon my manners, sir,
Shafto says, turning sideways.
Sir, my friend Goto Dengo. Goto-san, say hi to General of the Army Douglas MacArthur.
Goto Dengo has been standing there like a pillar of salt this whole time, utterly dumbfounded. But now he snaps out of it and bows very low. MacArthur nods crisply. His aide is staring darkly at Gododango and has already drawn his Colt.
"Pleasure," the general says airily. "Pray tell, what sort of business were you two gentlemen prosecuting in the ladies?"
Bobby Shafto knows how to lunge for an opening.
It's very funny you should ask that question, sir,"
he says offhandedly.
"But Goto-san just now saw the light and converted to Christianity."
Some nips on top of the wall open up on them with a machine gun. The flimsy tumbling rounds crack through the air and thump into the ground. General of the Army Douglas MacArthur stands motionless for a long time, lips pursed. He sniffles once. Then he removes his aviator glasses carefully and wipes his eyes on the immaculate sleeve of his uniform. He pulls out a neatly folded white hanky and wraps it around his hawk-like nose and honks into it a few times. He folds it up carefully and puts it back in his pocket, squares his shoulders, and then walks right up to Gododango and wraps him up in a big, manly bear hug. The remainder of the general's aides emerge from the shitter block and view the scene with reticence and palpable tension all over their faces. Profoundly mortified, Bobby Shafto looks down at his feet, wiggles his toes, and caresses the linear scab running upside his head where the ore clocked him a few days ago. The machine gun crew up on the wall are being picked off, one by one, by a sniper. They writhe and scream operatically. The hooks have come up from the dugout and stumbled into this little tableau. They all stand motionless, with their jaws hanging down around their navels. Finally, MacArthur unhands the stiff body of Gododango, steps back dramatically, and presents him to his staff.
"Meet Godo-san," he announces. "You have all heard the expression, the only good nip is a dead nip? Well, this young fellow is a counterexample. And as we learned in mathematics, it only takes one counterexample to disprove the theorem."
His staff observe cautious silence.
"It seems only fitting that we take this young fellow to the Church of St. Augustine, over yonder and into Moros, to carry out the sacrament of baptism,"
the general says. One of the aides steps forward, hunched over in that he's expecting to get a slug between the shoulder blades any minute.
"Sir, it is my duty to remind you that Intermaros is still controlled by the enemy."
"Then it is high time we made our presence felt," MacArthur says. "Shafto will get us there. Shafto and these fine Filipino gentlemen."
The general throws one arm around Gododango's neck in a highly affectionate, companionable way, and begins strolling with him towards the nearest gate.
"I would like you to know, young man, that when I set up my headquarters in Tokyo, which, God willing, should be within a year, I want you there bright and early the first day."
"Yes, sir,"
Gododango says. All things considered, it is unlikely he would say anything else. Shafto draws a deep breath, tilts his head back, and stares up into a smoky heaven.
"God,"
he says.
"Usually I bow my head when I'm talking to you, but I figure this is a good time for us to have a face-to-face. You see and know all things, and so I will not explain the situation to you. I would just like to submit a request for you. I know you are getting requests from lonely soldiers all over the fucking place at this time, but since this one has to do with a shitload of women and children, and General MacArthur too, maybe you can jump me to the top of the stack? You know what I want. Let's get it done."
He borrows a small, straight 20-round Tommy gun magazine from one of his comrades, and they set out for Intermaros. The gates are sure to be guarded, so Shafto and the Hooks run up the sloping walls instead, directly beneath that wiped-out machine gun nest. They turn the gun around into Intermaros and plant one of the wounded Hooks there to operate it. The first time Shafto gazes into the town, he nearly falls off the wall. Intermaros is gone. If he didn't know where he was, he would never recognize it. Essentially, all of the buildings have been leveled. Manila Cathedral and the Church of St. Augustine still stand, both with heavy damage. A few of the fine old Spanish houses still exist as hasty freehand sketches of their former selves, missing roofs, wings, or walls. But most of the blocks are just jumbles of masonry and shattered red roof tiles, with smoke and steam seething out of them.
There are dead bodies all over the place, sowed all over the neighborhood like Timothy seed broadcast onto freshly plowed soil. The artillery is mostly stopped, there being nothing left to destroy. But small arms and machine gun fire sound on almost every block. Shafto is thinking he'll have to assault one of the gates, but before he can even come up with a plan, MacArthur is up there with the rest of his group, having scrambled up the rampart behind them. This is evidently the first time that the general has gotten a good look at Intramuros, because he is stunned and, for once, speechless. He stands there for a long time with his mouth open, and begins to draw fire from a few nips hidden in the wreckage below. The turned-around machine gun silences them. It takes them several hours to make their way up the street and into the Church of St. Augustine. A bunch of nips have barricaded themselves inside the place, along with what sounds like every hungry infant and irritable 2-year-old in Manila. The church is just one side of a large compound that includes a monastery and other buildings. Many of the structures have been torn open by artillery fire. The treasures hoarded in that place by the monks over the course of the last 500 years have tumbled out into the street, blown all over the neighborhood like shrapnel and commingled with the bayoneted corpses of Filipino boys are huge oil paintings of Christ being scourged, fantastic wooden sculptures of the Romans hammering the spikes through his wrists and ankles, marbles of Mary holding the dead and mangled Christ in her lap, tapestries of the whipping post and the cat-o'-nine-tails in action, blood coursing out of Christ's back through hundreds of parallel gouges. The nips, still inside the church, defend its main doors with the suicidal determination that Shafto has begun to find so tedious. But thanks to the general's artillery, there are plenty of other ways, besides doors, to get into the place now. So it is that, even while a company of American infantry mount a frontal assault on the main entrance, Bobby Shafto and his hooks, Goto Dango, the general, and his aides, are already kneeling in a little chapel in what used to be a part of the monastery. The padre leads them through a couple of extremely truncated prayers of thanksgiving and baptizes Goto Dango with water from a font, with Bobby Shafto taking the role of beaming parent and General of the Army Douglas MacArthur serving as godfather. Shafto later remembers only one line of the ceremony.
"Do you reject the glamour of evil and refuse to be mastered by it?" says the padre.
"I do,"
says MacArthur, with tremendous authority, even as Bobby Shafto is muttering,
"Fuck yes."
Goto Dango nods, gets wet, and becomes a Christian. Bobby Shafto excuses himself and goes wandering through the compound. It seems as big and crazy as that Casbah in Algiers, all gloomy and dusty on the inside, and filled with still more La Passion art, made by artists who had obviously witnessed whippings firsthand and who didn't need any priest spouting little homilies about the glamour of evil. He goes up and down the great stairway once, for old time's sake, remembering the night glory took him here. There is a courtyard with a fountain in the center, surrounded by a long shaded gallery where Spanish friars could stroll in the shade and look out over the flowers and hear the birds singing. Right now, the only things singing are shells passing overhead, but little Filipino kids are running races up and down the gallery, and their mothers and aunts and grannies are encamped in the courtyard, drawing water from the fountain and cooking rice over piles of burning chair legs. A gray-eyed 2-year-old with a makeshift bludgeon is chasing some bigger kids down a stone arcade. Some of his hairs are the color of Bobby's, and some are the color of Glory's. And Bobby Shafto can see gloriness shining almost fluoroscopically out of his face. The boy has the same bone structure that he saw on the sandbar a few days ago, but this time it is clothed in chubby pink flesh. The flesh admittedly bears bruises and abrasions, no doubt honorably earned. Bobby squats down and looks the little Shafto in the eye, wondering how to begin to explain everything. But the boy says,
"Bobby Shafto, you have boo-boos,"
and drops his club and walks up to examine the wounds on Bobby's arm. Little kids don't bother to say hello, they just start talking to you. And Shafto figures that's a good way to handle what would otherwise be pretty damn awkward. The Altamirers have probably been telling little Douglas M. Shafto since the day he was born that one day Bobby Shafto would come in glory from across the sea. That he has now done so is just as routine and yet just as much of a miracle as that the sun rises every day.
I see that you and yours have displayed adaptability, and that is good,
says Bobby Shafto to his son, but sees immediately that he is not getting through to the kid at all. He feels a need to get something into the kid's head that is going to stick, and this need is stronger than the craving for morphine or sex ever was. So he picks up the boy and carries him through the compound, down semi-collapsed hallways and over settling rubble heaps and between dead Nipponese boys to that big staircase, and shows him the giant slabs of granite, tells how they were laid, one on top of the next, year by year, as the galleons, full of silver, came from Acapulco. Doug M. Shafto has been playing with blocks, so he zeroes in on the basic concept right away. Dad carries son up and down the stairway a few times. They stand at the bottom and look up at it. The block analogy has struck deep. Without any prompting, Doug M. raises both arms over his head and hollers, "So big!" And the sound echoes up and down the stairs. Bobby wants to explain to the boy that this is how it's done. You pile one thing on top of the next, and you keep it up and keep it up. Sometimes the galleon sinks in a typhoon. You don't get your slab of granite that year. But you stick with it, and eventually you end up with something so big. He wishes that he could also make some further point about Glory and how she's been hard at work building her own staircase. Maybe if he was a word man like Enoch Root, he would be able to explain, but he knows that this is going way over the toddler's head, just as it went over Bobby's head when Glory first showed him the steps. The only thing that'll stick with Douglas MacArthur Shafto is the memory that his father brought him here and carried him up and down the staircase. And if he lives long enough and thinks hard enough, maybe he'll come to understand it too, the way Bobby does. That is a good enough start. Word has gotten around among the women in the courtyard that Bobby Shafto has arrived, better late than ever, and so he does not have time for meaningful speeches anyway. The Altamirers send him out on an errand to find Carlos, an 11-year-old boy who was rounded up a few days ago when the Nips swept through Malate. Shafto finds MacArthur and Goto Dengo first and excuses himself. Those two are deeply involved in a discussion of Goto Dengo's tunnel-building acumen and how it might be put to use during the rebuilding of Nippon, a project that the general is eager to launch as soon as he finishes reducing the entire Pacific Rim to rubble.
"You have sins to atone for, Shafto," the general says, "and you can't atone for them by getting down on your knees and saying Hail Marys."
"I understand that, sir,"
Shafto says.
"I have a little job that needs doing, precisely the kind of thing for which a marine raider with parachute training would be ideally suited."
"What's the Department of the Navy going to think of that, sir?"
"I have no intention of letting the swabbies know I found you until you have carried out this mission. But when you are finished, all is forgiven."
"I'll be right back,"
Shafto says.
"Where are you going, Shafto?"
"Got some other people who need to forgive me first."
He heads in the direction of Fort Santiago with a reconstituted, rearmed, and beefed-up squad of hooks. The old Spanish fort has been liberated within the last couple of hours by the Americans. They have thrown open the doors to the dungeons and the subterranean caverns along the Pasig River. Finding 11-year-old Carlos Altamira is, then, a problem of sorting through several thousand corpses. Almost all of the Filipinos who were herded into this place by the Nips died, either through out-and-out execution or by suffocating in the dungeons,
or by drowning when the tide came up the river and flooded the cells. Bobby Shafto doesn't really know what Carlos looked like, and so the best he can do is cull out the young-looking corpses and present them to members of the Altamira family for inspection. The Benzedrine he took a couple of days ago has worn off, and he feels half-dead himself. He trudges through the Spanish dungeon with a kerosene lantern, shining the dim yellow light on the faces of the dead, muttering the words to himself like a prayer.
Do you reject the glamour of evil and refuse to be mastered by it?
Wisdom. A few years ago, when Randy became tired of the ceaseless pressure in his lower jaw, he went out onto the North Central Californian oral surgery market, looking for someone to extract his wisdom teeth. His health plan covered this, so price was not an obstacle. His dentist took one of those big cinemascopic wraparound x-rays of his entire lower head, the kind where they pack your mouth with half a roll of high-speed film and then clamp your head in a jig and the x-ray machine revolves around you spraying radiation through a slit as the entire staff of the dentist's office hits the deck behind a lead wall, resulting in a printed image that is a none-too-appetizing distortion of his jaw into a single flat plane. Looking at it, Randy eschewed cruder analogies like head of a man run over several times by steamroller while lying flat on his back, and tried to think of it as a mapping transformation. Just one more in mankind's long history of ill-advisedly trying to represent 3D stuff on a flat plane. The corners of this coordinate plane were anchored by the wisdom teeth themselves, which, even to the dentally unsophisticated Randy, looked just a little disturbing, in that each one was about the size of his thumb. Though maybe this was just a distortion in the coordinate transform, like the famously swollen Greenland of Mercator. And they were pretty far away from any other teeth, which, logically, would seem to put them in parts of his body not normally considered to be within a dentist's purview, and they were at the wrong angle. Not just a little crooked, but verging on upside down and backwards. At first, he just chalked all of this up to the Greenland phenomenon. With his jaw map in hand, he hit the streets of Three Siblings Land, looking for an oral surgeon. It was already beginning to work on him psychologically. Those were some big-ass teeth. Brought into being by the workings of relict DNA strands from the hunter-gatherer epoch, designed for reducing tree bark and mammoth gristle to easily digestible paste. Now these boulders of living enamel were horrifyingly adrift in a gracile Cro-Magnon head that simply did not have room for them. Think of the sheer extra weight he had been carrying around. Think of the use that priceless head real estate could have been put to. When they were gone, what would fill up the four giant molar-shaped voids in his melon? It was moot until he could find someone to get rid of them. But one oral surgeon after another turned him down. They would put the x-ray up on their light boxes, stare into it, and blanch. Maybe it was just the pale light coming out of the light boxes, but Randy could have sworn they were blanching. Disingenuously, as if wisdom teeth normally grew someplace completely different, they all pointed out that the wisdom teeth were buried deep, deep, deep in Randy's head. The lowers were so far back in his jaw that removing them would practically break the jawbone in twain structurally. From there, one false move would send a surgical steel demolition pick into his middle ear. The uppers were so deep in his skull that the roots were twined around the parts of his brain responsible for perceiving the color blue on one side and being able to suspend one's disbelief in bad movies on the other. And between these teeth and actual air, light, and saliva lay many strata of skin, meat, cartilage, major nerve cables, brain-feeding arteries, bulging caches of lymph nodes, girders, and trusses of bone, rich marrow that was working just fine, thank you, a few glands whose functions were unsettlingly poorly understood, and many of the other things that made Randy Randy, all of them definitely falling into the category of sleeping dogs. Oral surgeons, it seemed, were not comfortable delving more than elbow deep into a patient's head. They've been living in big houses and driving to work in Mercedes-Benz sedans long before Randy had dragged his sorry ass into their offices with his horrifying X-ray, and they had absolutely nothing to gain by even attempting to remove these. Not so much wisdom teeth in the normal sense as apocalyptic portents from the Book of Revelations. The best way to remove these teeth was with a guillotine. None of these oral surgeons would even consider undertaking the extraction until Randy had signed a legal disclaimer too thick to staple, something that almost had to come in a 3-ring binder, the general import of which was that one of the normal consequences of the procedure was for the patient's head to end up floating in a jug of formaldehyde in a tourist trap just over the Mexican border. In this manner, Randy wandered from one oral surgeon's office to another for a few weeks, like a teratomic outcast roving across a post-nuclear wasteland, being driven out of one village after another by the brickbats of wretched, terrified peasants. Until one day, when he walked into an office and the nurse at the front desk almost seemed to expect him and led him back into an exam room for a private consult with the oral surgeon, who was busy doing something in one of his little rooms that involved putting a lot of bone dust into the air. The nurse bade him sit down, proffered coffee, then turned on the light box and took Randy's X-rays and stuck them up there. She took a step back, crossed her arms, and gazed at the pictures in wonder. "So," she murmured, "these are the famous wisdom teeth." That was the last oral surgeon Randy visited for a couple of years. He still had that relentless 24 jam pressure in his head, but now his attitude had changed. Instead of thinking of it as an anomalous condition easily remedied, it became his personal cross to bear, and really not all that bad compared to what some people had to suffer with. There, as in many other unexpected situations, his extensive fantasy role-playing game experience came in handy, as while spinning out various epic scenarios, he had inhabited the minds, if not the bodies, of many characters who were missing limbs or had been burned over some algorithmically determined percentages of their bodies by dragon's breath or wizard's fireball, and it was part of the ethics of the game that you had to think pretty hard about what it would actually be like to live with such injuries and to play your character accordingly. By those standards, feeling all the time like you had an automotive jack embedded in your skull, ratcheting up the pressure one click every few months, was not even worth mentioning. It was lost in the somatic noise. So Randy lived that way for several years as he and Charlene insensibly crept upwards on the socioeconomic scale and began finding themselves at parties with people who had arrived in Mercedes-Benzes. It was at one of these parties where Randy overheard a dentist extolling some brilliant young oral surgeon who had just moved to the area. Randy had to bite his tongue not to start asking all kinds of questions about just what brilliant meant in an oral surgery context, questions that were motivated solely by curiosity, but that the dentist would be likely to take the wrong way. Among coders, it was pretty obvious who was brilliant and who wasn't, but how could you tell a brilliant oral surgeon apart from a merely excellent one? It gets you into deep epistemological shit. Each set of wisdom teeth could only be extracted once. You couldn't have 100 oral surgeons extract the same set of wisdom teeth and then compare the results scientifically. And yet it was obvious from watching the look on this dentist's face that this one particular oral surgeon, this new guy, was brilliant. So later Randy sidled up to this dentist and allowed as how he might have a challenge. He might personally embody a challenge that would put this ineffable quality of oral surgery brilliance to some good use. And could he have the guy's name, please? A few days later he was talking to this oral surgeon, who was indeed young and conspicuously bright and had more in common with other brilliant people Randy had known, mostly hackers, than he did with other oral surgeons. He drove a pickup truck and kept fresh copies of Turing magazine in his waiting room. He had a beard and a staff of nurses and other female acolytes who were all permanently aflutter over his brilliantness and followed him around, steering him away from large obstacles and reminding him to eat lunch. This guy did not blanch when he saw Randy's Mercator rentgenogram on his light box. He actually lifted his chin up off his hand and stood a little straighter and spake not for several minutes. His head moved minutely every so often as he animadverted on a different corner of the coordinate plane and admired the exquisitely grotesque situation of each tooth, its paleolithic heft and its long, gnarled roots trailing off into parts of his head never charted by anatomists. When he finally turned to face Randy, he had this priest-like aura about him, a kind of holy ecstasy, a feeling of cosmic symmetry revealed, as if Randy's jaw and his brilliant oral surgery brain had been carved out by the architect of the universe 15 billion years ago specifically so that they could run into each other here and now in front of this light box. He did not say anything like, "Randy, let me just show you how close the roots of this one tooth are to the bundle of nerves that distinguishes you from a marmoset," or, "My schedule is incredibly full and I was just thinking of going into the real estate business anyway," or, "Just a second while I call my lawyer." He didn't even say anything like, "Wow, those suckers are really in deep." The young, brilliant oral surgeon just said, "Okay," stood there awkwardly for a few moments, and then walked out of the room in a display of social ineptness that totally cemented Randy's faith in him. One of his minions eventually had Randy sign a legal disclaimer stipulating that it was perfectly all right if the oral surgeon decided to feed Randy's entire body into a log chipper, but this, for once, seemed like just a formality and not the opening round in an inevitable Bleak House-like litigational saga. And so finally the big day came, and Randy took care to enjoy his breakfast because he knew that, considering the nerve damage he was about to incur, this might be the last time in his life that he would be able to taste food or even chew it. The oral surgeon's minions all looked at Randy in awe when he actually walked in the door of their office, like, "My God, he actually showed up," then flew reassuringly into action. Randy sat down in the chair and they gave him an injection, and then the oral surgeon came in and asked him what, if anything, was the difference between Windows 95 and Windows NT. "This is one of these conversations the sole purpose of which is to make it obvious when I have lost consciousness, isn't it?" Randy said. "Actually, there is a secondary purpose, which is that I am considering making the jump and wanted to get some of your thoughts about that," the oral surgeon said. "Well," said Randy, "I have a lot more experience with Unix than with NT, but from what I've seen, it appears that NT is really a decent enough operating system and certainly more of a serious effort than Windows." He paused to draw breath and then noticed that suddenly everything was different.